We've got a very deep story for you now on Sunday Extra, because the undersea cable that made the global internet possible is in the process of being removed from the ocean floor. TAT-8 is the 6,000-kilometre transatlantic telephone cable number 8, which was the first fibre optic cable ever laid across an ocean, and which started carrying traffic on the 14th of December 1988. Actually, about 98% of all global internet traffic travels not via satellites, but under the sea via the 1.5 million kilometres of fibre optic cable that's on the ocean floor. Jane Rufino is a doctoral researcher at Södertörn University in Sweden who focuses on the material culture of the subsea cable industry. And she's on a self-declared mission to help people understand that the networks that we rely on are made of physical things created and maintained by people. And Jane wrote a fascinating piece about TAT-8 and the folks involved in pulling it up for Wired magazine. I'm very pleased to say that she joins us, almost certainly via undersea cable, from Stockholm, Sweden, now on Sunday Extra. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. And yes, this is definitely going via cable, whereas our local traffic doesn't always need subsea connections.
And it's coming through crystal clear, which is lovely and a testament to the quality of these undersea fibre optic cables. But Jane, tell us more about TAT-8 and why it's so important.
TAT-8 is important because it was the first cable to use fibre optic technology. And one of the things that I came across as I was researching this piece is that fibre optic technology had really only been kind of used on land for a couple of years when these companies committed to building this across the sea. So you have your first terrestrial fiber optic systems on land in like the mid-70s, 1975, 1976. And within a couple of years, these companies had committed to building this across the sea, which is a pretty astonishing thing. You know, we got this working locally in our little town, and now we're going to do it across the sea at depths that would, you know, crush your skull. So the other thing that's important to know, I mean, we hear now about, you know, oh, but satellites are the future. I mean, satellites will not compete on capacity with submarine cables. But back in the 60s and 70s, the subsea cable industry for telecommunications, that it was really at risk. I mean, there are companies that kind of said, we're cooked, like we're done. Satellites are going to eat our business. And in a way, because these cables were laid for phone calls, they were not laid for the internet. You know, it's a little bit of a stretch to say that TAT-8 was the first internet cable. It would have been the first fiber cable that internet traffic traveled on. But if you remember, in the early days, you got on the internet with a phone call. Yeah. So even that was like, it was counted in circuits. So it was a really different time. And what happened was, in the 70s, in the US, the Federal Communications Commission said, you know, if you don't do something, we're not going to approve any more subsea cables. So they really had to make this work. They had to make it work, and they did. And that was the thing that was the most astonishing. It wasn't just this kind of like natural progression of technology. This was something that had kind of started as a Victorian party trick and evolved through having some medical uses. And the idea of using it for telecommunications was really only first discussed in the 1960s by a guy named Charles Cow. And then, you know, even by the 70s, the idea of actually making it work over long distances, it was a stretch. It was a big stretch. And so that was what helped me to kind of see this is what's really important about it. Not that it made the internet possible, but it sort of represents this this era where you had this incredible international collaboration between all of these people at a time when, you know, we're sort of in the last days of these huge labs like Bell Labs being able, people at Bell Labs just having this kind of almost, I don't want to say a blank check, but, you know, really just incredible scope to get things done. It must have been an amazing place to work.
Fiber optic cables are still the way that all this global traffic is zipping around the world to the present day. So why is it that TAT-8 isn't still being used?
We generally hear that cables have a use life of about 25 years. That's kind of just in general, after a while, your cable will go out of service. You'll have to take it out of service if you know, it can't make money anymore. So if it needs lots of repairs, and that every repair can add latency and slow things down. But also the technology for TAT-8 was surpassed really quickly, not to diminish the achievement of getting this cable to work, but then the technology improved really quickly. By around the early 2000s, it had just had so many faults. It needed so many repairs that it wasn't worth, and there were so many other cables by then.
So it's been out of commission for quite a while. I suppose that leads to the question of why then are there efforts now being undertaken to retrieve TAT-8 from the ocean floor?
Somebody actually sent me something the other day showing that there was a plan in around 2003, 2004 to pick it up then, but it just didn't turn out to be financially viable. And really, it's that now the recycling industry is probably more mature. The price of copper, because these cables, a lot of people, because we compare fiber with the earlier copper systems, which we call coaxial systems, we forget or aren't really aware that these cables have a lot of copper in them. So that those materials are needed in the supply chain, but it's also because the popular routes for these long distance cables are really busy. We think, I mean, the seabed is huge, but it's also very busy. And clearing space along established routeways, because doing route clearance, route surveys, that's a huge part of the work of the cable industry. And now you have all these other seabed users like offshore wind and all these renewable industries that need seabed space. So it's become more valuable to remove them. And these companies have now sprung up. There's only a few of them that make this their business. And there are places, there are countries where you have to remove your decommissioned cables, but it's not everywhere. And it's not necessarily the whole cable. And this, again, this is not the whole cable. They only retrieve what is sitting on the surface. They're not going to pull it from a trench or underneath another cable or anything like that.
So Jane, could you tell us, how do you retrieve an undersea cable, and who's trying to do it?
These companies actually, or this Subsea, the company that I have been following, and they've been so generous with their time, they buy the cables. They buy the old cables, and sometimes even tracking down the owners, because some of these cables have been out of commission for, 20 years or longer, as in the case of TAT-8, and actually some of the companies have gone out of business. It can be hard to find out who owns a cable. Sometimes you see a cable and then you have to find the company, or you find out about a cable and then you have to see if it's still there. So it's quite a fun, I mean, it's sort of like an archive adventure, these desktop surveys that they do. So they buy the cables, and then they have to make a plan to pick them up. And something that I thought was quite fun, especially as an archaeologist, you pull the newest things up first if you're doing an excavation, is that's kind of how they have to pick them up off the seabed. So they started picking up these TAT systems. The TAT systems went up to TAT 14. They've actually, TAT 14, they already picked up, because they had to start at the last one, because you have to pick them up like chopsticks. And they have their own ship, and they have two ships. Actually, one stays in the Pacific and one stays in the Atlantic. And they go out, they have to go out to where they have what's called a route positioning list, which is a big spreadsheet. And they can see, where is it buried? Where is it on the surface? Where was there a repair? Where are all the repeaters? And then they find the places where they're pretty sure it is. And they can usually get it to within a few hundred meters. But things shift on the seabed. It's not, not a lot happens, but things shift around, or they just aren't exactly where you thought. And they drop a hook. And this is the thing that was so much fun. And to me, by the time I got to this piece, I'm so used to now hearing all of the ways that the cable industry relies on old methods, old machinery, old knowledge. But it's still really fun to hear. So they have this grapnel hook, and they drop it off the bow of the ship, and they wait. I mean, imagine how long it takes for this hook to hit the seabed at 5 kilometers. It's just floating down. And then they do what's called a cutting run. So they drive the ship really slowly, and they just wait for it to show tension.
Sounds exactly like fishing.
It is exactly like fish, and they call it going fishing for cable. And I will say there's one part of this method that does sound like it's different. Apparently, back in the 1860s, somebody used to sit on the winch, wait to feel it. So they no longer sit on the winch, as far
probably
as
probably for
I
the
know.
Best.
yeah, but they do call it fishing for cable. And then if they catch the cable, then they bring it up, and they can bring it up. And sometimes you bring up a small section, and then sometimes you can bring up a longer section. And then you sort of cut off where you know maybe something crosses it, or you get to a point where you're pretty sure it's buried under the seabed. So they bring it up onto the ship. And then it's pulled onto the ship. It goes down this kind of small conveyor belt down into the hold. And down in the hold, you have a team of two coiling the cable, because you have to coil it by hand. Otherwise, it's so thin that you can't coil it with a machine in the hold. You have to just like slowly walk backwards, making a nice, neat stack.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Jane Ruffino, who wrote the article in Wired magazine, Say Goodbye to the Undersea Cable That Made the Global Internet Possible. Jane, when they actually do successfully fish for Tat-8, how big is the actual cable?
The cable is about as thick as like a dinner candle. That's the best. People say garden hose, but I actually think a dinner candle is the best reference. And they are quite innocuous looking. You would not look at this and think that it could carry as much traffic as it can, or that it would be as durable as it is.
And clearly valuable as well. So when a large section of Tat-8 or another undersea cable is recovered, what becomes of it, Jane?
This company, they coil it in the hold. Then they get into port and they pull it all out of the hold and they stack it in bales, and then they load it onto a ship. And it's sent to another company, one of their kind of collegial competitors, as they call them, who have a recycling facility. And they take apart the cable, and there's copper, and that gets put back in the supply chain. It's super pure copper, too, so it's really valuable. And steel, I guess they've said that it gets turned into things like vineyard fencing, game fencing. And then the plastic is turned into non-food grade consumer plastic. So, you know, things like shampoo bottles. And that's really what got me so excited about the cable recovery process, is just realizing that these materials are all, not only is the infrastructure of our communications all around us, the materials from it are all around us in materials and in objects that we might not even think about.
And Jane, you mentioned that Tat-8 was taken out of commission due to being surpassed as a technology, but also maintenance problems. It seems there's a bit of a mythology about what exactly was causing some of the maintenance problems. Can you tell us once and for all, are sharks to blame for the demise of Tat-8?
No, they're not. And you know, it's so funny because I was not going to talk about sharks. There's nothing that frustrates the industry more than people asking or talking about sharks. It's like, oh no, we're going to talk about sharks. So no. And also Tat-8 itself was never the subject of shark speculation. It was a test system that was built in the Canary Islands.
Yeah, because extraordinary lengths have been gone to try and make these cables fish or shark proof. Why were those efforts undertaken?
What I think is really interesting, and why I decided, okay, this actually does belong in the piece, is that we're talking about a technology that couldn't fail. They could not fail. If this cable failed, they were cooked. I mean, okay, if these types of cables, there were other systems already being planned at this time, but the industry was cooked if this didn't work. And they really didn't know. I mean, now in hindsight, people realize it, but this was a different technology than what had been built before. To me, it represents a time when, and a group of people who were able to mitigate every risk. They were able to say, we need to do a good job. We need to make sure this works, and there will be, we will go down every rabbit hole. And actually, when you think about the lengths they went to, it was a few experiments, right? Like, so in the scheme of things, this cable cost something like $330 million, which is around $1 billion today. So what, you know, you spend a couple hundred grand to do a couple of experiments with sharks. But the reason I think that it ended up in the press kit, because that's where I was like, AT&T talked about this themselves. This was their 5 pages of it. And I think one of the reasons is, you know, the technology for copper cable for phone calls was brand new. You could not make a phone call across the ocean before 1956 when TAT-1 went into service. But by the time TAT-8 went into service, you know, not that many people made international phone calls, and they weren't going to make them cheaper. I think that was like, what can we say about this technology, given that the whole purpose of this cable is like to maintain our monopoly, not make phone calls cheaper. So the technology was really huge and really different. But for the consumer, it didn't change as much. So it was like a good story. So it was a good news hook. And it's also like, it's the 80s. It was still Jaws times. And, you know, the ocean was synonymous with Jaws. I mean, I grew up in the Boston area, and, you know, Jaws was everything. The ocean was Jaws, not just sharks. So I think it tapped into a cultural moment that was still being felt at that time. But it really is not a risk. And the other thing that made me want to write a little about it is that the conclusion was, well, we actually don't think that this is happening, but we're not entirely sure whether, I mean, these cables are lighter than what came before, so they needed a little more protection. And what happened was that they added this layer of protection, which they at the time called fish bite proofing, and now it's called lightweight armor, and it made the cables a bit stronger. So I kind of love the fact that the perception of sharks helped to make the cables stronger, so the sharks were actually helpful. And I will say, sharks and cables face a common threat, and that is the fishing industry. That is industrial fishing. So they have a common enemy.
Well, Jane, I think you've proved it even through to this day, and despite no doubt the frustration of deep sea cable enthusiasts, the shark still is a good hook. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's Jane Ruffino, and her piece in Wired magazine is headed "Say Goodbye to the Undersea Cable That Made the Global Internet Possible."
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.